Hi, everybody. Welcome to the second podcast of myself, Esther Chesterman, and my partner in our podcasting. Hi, Samreen.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm okay. It's lovely to be here again.
Good, good. Yes, I'm really excited about our second discussion. So as I said, a second podcast. Thank you so much to those who've engaged and contacted us regarding our first topic. First topic seems to have ignited a little bit of a discussion. Mm. So that was around access arrangements. I think we chose that one quite well, really, actually, didn't we, Samreen?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a topic really close to our hearts.
Exactly. So really good that it chimed with a few of our listeners as well. So thank you for that. Would you like to introduce this week's topic?
So the topic that I've really been pushing for us to talk about and really excited to talk about is one around school refusal. And the reason being is because when we went into lockdown and, you know, schools shut for our students, that brought with this issues around many young people struggling to go back to school. And the whole issues and the concerns around school refusals became present again, not only in the media, but also it's a topic of conversation that everyone's talking about in schools.
Yeah.
And I think it's something really worth discussing and hearing about what's going on here and what the solutions are.
That's really good. Yes, and I'm keen to talk about it as well with you. And we've had a chat earlier, and I think one of the aspects that we thought we'd dive straight into, which is I think one of the most almost contentious parts of this topic, is the title, the definition, or the words that are used to describe this what's happening. So school refusal, I think, is quite a legacy term, really, isn't it, for something that is happening with a child. The definitions I've sort of come across from a couple of organisations, the charity Young Minds, they've put forward terms such as emotionally based school avoidance or anxiety related absence. And then there's a great website called Not Fine in School. I don't know whether you come across those.
Yes.
They've also talked about flipping it around to barriers to attendance. What's your thinking on that sort of terminology and that aspect of definition?
I think it's really good. I mean, I'm always really interested in why we choose certain terms and what the impact that has. And we can kind of understand why people feel concerned about the term school refusal, because refusal sounds like a choice. And when you go further in it, often when it was seen that a child was refusing, it was seen, if we go back further, that they were behaving badly. And they were refusing to behave well, and therefore making a choice and refusing to come to school. And in that, often the attitude that could be in that is that you're not behaving well, you're not doing what is right, and you're making a choice here, and that is to not come to school. And because refusal is such a loaded term, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that emotive aspect for the child, for the parents and carers who are involved with the child's education, and to the teachers as well. So it sets a sort of an approach, doesn't it, I think, which is something that I know a few of the organisations are trying to break down. Data-wise, so the Office for National Statistics released some data just last month, around 2020-21. Overall absence rates was 4.6%, which just tells us that. Interestingly, 12% of pupils missed 10% or more of their school, which that surprised me, actually. And some of the data, there was a research paper put forward in 2018 by Professor Claudia Allen, saying that this type of anxiety-related absence can affect between 5 to 28% of school-aged children at some point. So it's something that's not going to go away.
Yeah.
It, as you've rightly said, is increasing.
Mm.
So what does it look like from your perspective, Samreen? What are you seeing? What's this whole complexity of individual, family, social factors, chronic illness, mental health, all these sorts of, really complex emotional trauma that's potentially happening to a child. What are you seeing?
So I find this really interesting because of my role working in a mental health setting in a school. I see refusal all the time as kind of, it's really common for us to deal with refusal, and that can go from a child refusing to engage in the classroom or struggling to come into school, like struggling with that part of it to even be there. And we've always seen that show itself and play itself out. And the thing that has always interested me about this is that that refusal can often come around during times of transition when a young person feels unsafe. Mm-hmm. And so what they're doing is trying to make sure that they are as safe as possible, and transitioning into school or transitioning into where their place of safety is, where they can then fall into refusal. And it's interesting that post lockdown that we've seen an increase in this happening as we move out of it. And going back in terms of where these come from, it's such a complex issue. It's so individual as to why a child may come to the point where they struggle to come to school, that it can come from either from being, from feeling like I can't cope with school, I can't cope with the expectations, or it could come from some other trauma. But what I do know is that if a child is in that position where they are struggling to come to school, struggling to attend, then that there is something much more serious behind that. And that's something we need to look at, because I feel, and I think it is a symptom of something else going on there. And whether that is that just that they are not they are struggling with the transition, struggling with the change that's happening.
Yeah, that's fascinating, and it's interesting you've noticed some of the trigger points.
Yeah.
What if we're looking at it from a, perhaps look at it from three different perspectives. You've explained a little bit about from a child's perspective, a small amount there. What about from a parent's perspective? What do you hear parents are feeling and struggling with around this? Because it must be quite a scary place to be.
And I think parents can feel a great sense of failure over it. I mean, if at the very basic level that as a parent you are unable to take your child to school, that is really difficult, because we know that parents can get fined if their children don't go to school. So there's a fear as well that I'm going to be judged for this. But this is why we'd encourage, if you know your child is struggling with coming to school, that you let the school know, and it becomes an authorized medical absence. We don't want that recorded as kind of unauthorized. There's a reason why that's happening. And I think for parents, they can feel quite hopeless. It can feel quite a sense of failure. And also it's really difficult to see your child struggle to go to school, something that we expect all children to do, and then suddenly you find that they're finding it really difficult, and it can creep up on you. And I've heard parents say that it sort of happened all of a sudden. First of all, they're very getting ready for school very slowly, or things aren't quite perfect in the way that they're, their homework's not right enough then in order for them to be able to go to school. And it's the excuses that are built up until it gets to a point where I can't leave the house anymore. And I think from a parent's perspective, that's really difficult, because you can feel quite isolated in that. But there is help out there.
That's really good. Interesting point, but also very clearly put across. I mean, because I can empathise being a parent, how that would feel. And as you know, when you're parenting, any flashpoint can then breed more poor behaviour between you and your child, and the communication can start to break down. One of the studies put forward, and I'll just read a little bit that was carried out, a bleak, adversarial, lonely picture for parents, which are very strong words. Findings depict a system rife with parental blame, a system that appears to isolate parents through hostile, threatening and punitive actions.
Right.
So when I read that, I thought, gosh, imagine being, you know, my children now grown up, and I didn't face any of those types of issues. But they're really strong words, aren't they? And
yeah.
I can imagine that could be how a parent is feeling.
Mm.
Particularly because, as you say, there's the fine aspect, so there's that punitive aspect of what's happening.
Mm.
So from a school's perspective, I think you engage with schools, obviously.
Yeah.
You are sort of supporting children when these transition stages, and obviously supporting them to integrate into school. Is it a challenge for schools and teachers then? Is there a systemic way that they behave that perhaps needs reflecting on? Have you got a sort of feel around how schools are at the moment approaching this?
I think it's difficult, and I think every child being an individual, that they have, there is an individual way of dealing with that child, and I think the fact that it's in the news, that schools are struggling with it, that there isn't a one answer to it, but there are definitely things that can be put in place, and I do believe that there are ways in which schools as a whole can be better at managing this. I think if a school, I mean, it is the school, the parent, the child come together in order for this to work, or the school and the parent wrap the care around the child. And I do think that if there is some better understanding that this issue is to do with, for example, the difficulty around transition, or we haven't even spoke around, you know, the fact that if you're autistic or you've got a learning difficulty, there's going to be difficulty there with attendance and so on. And so I think there are things that can be done. And if a student is struggling, then I think there are measures that schools can put in place.
Yeah.
And that's where the parent does need to speak to the school. They need to communicate. I hope they feel comfortable to communicate clearly that this is what's happening. The SENCO would be involved. You'd have an individual education plan. And what you'd hope is, what really helps, and if we just take one example, that the transition is difficult, that the child feels unsafe, then you'd think, okay, what are the steps that I can do to make this better? And it is about being really structured, so they know every step, this is what's going to happen. You think school has a structure and it's quite straightforward, but it's almost sometimes when I've managed young people through this, I've even got to a point where I've said, okay, you're going to walk up to the door, and this person's going to be standing at the door, and once they're standing at the door, you're going to walk with them to this point. And it's like you're detailing every aspect of it, and that transition is managed really carefully. Now, that might not be practical for everyone, but that's one example of how that can be done. It's being very structured. It's giving written instructions if you need to. It's making those really clear, and that you would work with the school to say, well, what's best for my child? What would work here for them?
That's great. So it's supportive, collaborative, and responsive, and without punishment, and without language that feels punitive.
Yeah, without judgment.
Yeah. Really good, thank you. And I suppose it's also looking at holistic solutions, isn't it? Because the behaviour that's being displayed by the child, there may be so many layers of other factors that are affecting the child being unable to attend school. So, but just, I mean, the SENCOs are very highly trained. I mean, is there some more resource that needs to be put into schools around raising awareness, development of key personnel in the school to understand how to react to this? Because you'll have one child's behaviour, but it could be the school climate, economic disadvantage, inconsistent parenting. It could be a huge range of different reasons, couldn't it?
Absolutely it can. And I think you're right. And it's about being more aware of mental health and anxiety and stress factors and triggers. And I agree with, the more support that's in schools, the more teachers are also trained to look out for this, to see signs for it. The most common refusal I've often seen is around perfectionism, where a pupil can care so much about their grades, so much about not getting those grades, that the only way to manage that is to just shut down completely from it. And therefore, what when you say about resources that are needed, the work that's needed there is helping people through that difficult transition or that change that's taking place with the expectations we put on students on exam results or on, or managing. So yes, and I think also around noticing around periods of transition and how that support can happen. So when we have primary to children going from primary to secondary, or from secondary moving on to the next stage over there, and every time those movements happen, what is the support that's in place? I do think that the more research that is done around this, though, the more understanding that's done around why kids fall into struggling to come into school, why they have attendance issues, I think the more we can train and develop our own resources in schools as well.
No, I agree. A school such as the one that you're sort of working in at the moment, Sammy, where do you, would you come in to that type of scenario, or are you different types of scenarios?
Actually, I think it's quite interesting because we're a hospital school. Our young people come to us often already in a state of refusal because we're a unit, a hospital for children with eating disorders for anorexia. And what happens is they usually fall away from education around that. Their education has become fractured. They've already stopped attending. Not everyone, but often that's the case. So one of the jobs we have is to try and re-engage them into education. And that's often a confidence and self-esteem and trust exercise that we represent school and you can trust us. And that can happen any form. If they're on the ward, that's the first place we visit, and I visit, I see myself as school with a friend in a friendly as approachable and as kind and as welcoming, but that's who I am until they can trust me in order to make that transition into the school building, into our tiny little school building.
So it's reframing education for them, isn't it, as being something. That's great. It's interesting to that, there are alternatives for children out there. Obviously, there's someone like the National Extension College who can really support a child to continuing with their study and their learning, but potentially as a stopgap for it to be being at home or perhaps being online, but in a safe space in the school where the child doesn't need to actually engage with the school life. So there are options around that, but I think practice and policy, I think what we would like is all that to come together, really, wouldn't we?
But I think you also raise a really important point there that absolutely you want the help to come from school and you want the child to re-engage with school. But sometimes, and we know this because we've both had parents come to us in this in our profession, that there's an alternative needed. And what are those alternatives? Because does every school, the way it's presented, suit the child? And those are difficult conversations. They're not overnight sort of decisions. You come to that, but and you're talking about the National Extension College and other options that are available. Sometimes you have to look at everything that's out there.
Yes, and we do work with a wide range of schools, and schools who are very open, as your school, Sammy, to just looking. Well, what else is there? This is an individual, so what will work for them? And that's where my concern, comes from. Just to sort of summarise, is obviously we've been talking about the schools bill. We talked about the schools bill last week as well, and the current bill is looking much more around that sort of punitive aspect, and I'm concerned that that's taking a step back, to be honest, and that we're not looking at this from a restorative, collaborative sort of position, which is a concern, I think. But so we haven't solved this, but
No.
it's been really interesting to explore it further. So hopefully our listeners have it's perhaps triggered some thoughts, some sort of conversations they might feel they can have either at school or with other professionals that they're working with. And as always, we'd love to hear, wouldn't we? Just any thoughts, comments, people's individual stories, really useful. And we hope as the podcast grows that we can start to share some of those with people and start to invite other speakers onto the podcast as well.
Absolutely.
Thank you for sharing this one with me, Samreen. It's been another deep dive, but interesting. So and we'll have please, any listeners, I think we're expecting people to perhaps come to us with some thoughts around the next topic. So we've got a few ideas, haven't we?
We have. We're excited for the next topic, which will be ready soon. Esther, it's always such a pleasure. I learned so much from you. Thank you.
Thank you, and you. Thank you very much. Take care.
Bye. Bye-bye.